The Dawn Recorded Lecture Service is pleased to present a session from the 1998 General Convention held at the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown, Pennsylvania. The speaker for this session is Brother Leo Post, whose subject is Early Work of the Harvest, 1874 to 1916. The topic that we have is one that might be considered a historical resume of the harvest work that was done at the here towards the end of the Gospel Age. I figure I have at least one very attentive person. That's Len Grice. He says, I love history. So we'll see how that goes, whether you'll think the same thing. Whenever we talk about the harvest work, though, we cannot forget the harvest work at the end of the Jewish age. Because that's where the first members of the body of Christ were found. And there's a lot of comparisons I'd like to make between that, but there isn't time to do all that. So, what we also want to note is that there was a preparatory work by God for this harvest that we're going to be talking about. After all, isn't it amazing that all these centuries, most of the world's population was over in Europe, Asia, Africa, and unknown to many except some few natives that were able to, as best as they can tell, cross over from Asia into North America. Nobody knew about North America and South America. They were hidden away. And how did they come to light? How did they get settled as a country? Religious persecution. When the religious persecution started, this country was a haven for people fleeing it. And this became now the home, the place where another important matter started to be taught. You know, up to this time, in Europe, in the various churches, they never talked about the second advent of Christ. Why? Probably because they felt that there is this doomsday idea. This is the end of everything. The longer we can keep away from it, the better. But now this doctrine was revived. It was revived here in the U.S. And the whole thing was important enough so it ended up in all of the history books for quite some time. I don't know if it's still there today, but it was back when I was taking history in school. And it was William Miller who was the first one who believed, through chronology and other studies of the scriptures, that Jesus was to come again in 1843. He had 50,000 followers. I know for a young country as the USA was back there, that's a lot of followers. And they all believe that this is going to happen. But like others today who are looking for Jesus to come again, they thought that they were going to be taken up into heaven. You know, you heard a lot about the rapture. And that Jesus was going to come in the flesh. Some of these ideas. Of course, that didn't happen. Now, 6 years later, in 1849, William Miller died. But what came out of that particular venture and teaching were a whole bunch of small Bible study classes as these brethren, these followers of William Miller, came together to study the Bible to find out where they went wrong. Why was it that this didn't happen like they said it would? And they were scattered throughout the country, which at that time, it didn't include California and the West. That was wild country back there. So, except a few cities on the coast. This is what was the outcome of the Miller movement. Now, as mentioned this morning by Brother Mike Balko, Charles Taze Russell was born in 1852. Now, it's interesting. That's 3 years after Miller died. And he grew up, young man, and he, as he also mentioned, you could see the Lord dealing with him because he had this bent towards religion. As a boy of 16 years of age, he joined the Congregational Church, joined the YMCA, and he wanted to serve God. But the teachings of the churches were that this great supreme creator of the universe that all of us worship and love, that he was the author of eternal torment. And you can see the adversary working here, friends, trying to drive the whole picture of what he probably knew was coming. And as Pastor Russell had these doubts of Salem, he's now 17 years old, he looked at all the other religions. Most of them were the Eastern religions, but he couldn't find anything to satisfy him. And that's when he decided that he's got to do some own personal study of the Bible to see what it really says. And then, when he was 18 years old, this is 1870 now, he found one of these Bible study groups in Allegheny, Pennsylvania, you know, that had arisen after the disappointment of Miller. He joined there with the brethren, and as a result of his enthusiasm for what they were already finding out, you'll notice that there were several Bible study groups around the country at that time as a leftover of the William Miller movement. Now, some of them formed their own theology and went their own way. But others kept just studying and studying and studying the Bible only and trying to find out what is God's plan. And so when he was in this new Bible study group in Allegheny, he was a good preacher, had a lot of talent. And so they made him pastor 4 years later. 24 years old, and a pastor of a congregation. That's a very young pastor. But he had the talent. And they realized that he would be a good pastor. And incidentally, that's the only title that he kept through all of his ministry. He became pastor of all the churches eventually. But let's continue. We are now at 1870, and 1874, that's when he became the pastor. It was also at that same time he started to get acquainted with a book that was written by Brother Payton, P-A-T-T-O-N. Called A Day Dawn. Now, he came from another group of Bible students over in Michigan. He lived in Elmont, Michigan, which is north of Detroit, about 40 miles. And The Day Dawn was something that he had put together. In fact, before Pastor Russell decided to publish his own journal, he had sent Brother Payton on a pilgrim trip to visit some of these classes that they knew about. There was very good intercommunication between these different classes. They knew each other. They were comparing notes. And they were all tending towards what we know today as the divine plan of the ages. And so he was busy. You heard the expression, oh, he has more time than money. Well, in this case, he had more money than time. Pastor Russell didn't have the time, but Brother Peyton did, and so he financed him personally to go and visit these brethren in the different areas. And then he took that kind of a trip himself, and that was the first pilgrim trip that Pastor Russell ever made. That was in the year 1880 that he made this first pilgrim trip. And to give you some idea of where he went to Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. You probably saw that on your way in. Reading, Pennsylvania. Newark, New Jersey. That's our backyard. And Lynn, Clinton, and Springfield, Massachusetts. Fort Edwards, New York. Then he stopped at Montrose, Pennsylvania, Berwick, and Jersey Shore, Pennsylvania. These are all places that we're well acquainted with today. And there were brethren there studying. Now, they didn't have ecclesias as we know them today. What form of organization they had, we just don't know, because as we look over the attempts made to educate the brethren about how things should be, the sixth volume didn't come on a scene until 1904. And it's like Brother Woodward said, 3/4 of the harvest were over and we still didn't have the sixth volume. And that's such an important book for organization, is it not? But somehow or other, some of these things would be put into the Zion's Watchtower. Now let's back up for a minute, because when I mentioned when Pastor Russell sent Brother Peyton out on a journey, he also then became assistant editor to N.H. Barber, who was the editor of a publication called The Herald of the Morning. That's a good title. That's kind of stuck with Bible students all the way back. And to also give you some idea of how these different ones knew each other, there was Brother Stetson, who lived up in Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. That's near Erie, Pennsylvania. He was a pastor of a large congregation. There was N.H. Barber in Rochester, New York, who had this publication about the Herald of the Morning. See, they're all tending now to talk about the dawning of a new day. And this was a sentiment that was flowing through all of these different classes. And then there was Brother George Storrs in New York. He was the editor of a publication called the Bible Examiner. And that particular publication had to cease because he became so ill, he was an older man too, that he couldn't carry it on. Now, Pastor Russell's helping out N.H. Barber with this new job of being an assistant editor. And 2 years later, Barber publishes an article that repudiates the ransom. Pastor Russell, being an assistant editor, had published, right under Barber's nose, a repudiation of that. And he also resigned. And he knew now that the only way he could contact people now was to have his own journal. So he gave up the merchandising business he was in, put all his money into the new venture of publishing Zion's Watchtower. And it started to go out to all the different brethren. Let me give you some idea of who the contributors were to that journal. Now, this started in 1879. By 1881, Brother J.H. Peyton, from Elmont, Michigan, was a regular contributor, supplying articles regularly. W.I. Manor from Braddock, Pennsylvania. B.W. Keith from Dansville, New York. A.D. Jones from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. L. Allen from Honeoye, New York. And J.C. Sunderland from Fort Edwards, New York. You know, when I mentioned this first pilgrim trip that Pastor Russell made, well, the first public witness that he gave was when Brother Stetson died. He was an elderly man. He was a pastor of this church. And he had written into his particular will that he didn't want anybody to give his funeral discourse except Charles Russell. And he was only 27 years old at the time. And he gave the funeral discourse for Brother Stetson. 1,200 people were there. That was his real first public witness. And what had happened is that everybody loved Brother Stetson so much that all the churches in the area closed down so the people could come to hear the funeral service for him. Isn't that remarkable? Well, we go along now, we're seeing that Pastor Russell has helpers helping him write articles and to help the brethren understand what the truth is all about. One of the mentions I made here of the trip in June that he made, he said that what he was really interested in was meeting the saints. Let's just back off now and remember that our Lord gave a parable, a very important parable, of the wheat and the tares. It's found in the 13th chapter of Matthew. And the Jewish harvest, of course, is mentioned by John the Baptist in Matthew 3:12, I think it is. But this now has to do with the gospel age harvest. And you know the story well. How at first there was a wheat field, and then the enemy came along and planted seeds of tares or imitation Christians, and they all grew together because they weren't supposed to get put, because you might pluck out some of the wheat if you try to pluck out the tares. After the apostles fell asleep. And then the Lord says, when the time comes for the harvest, we'll then take the tares and put them in bundles, and then we'll bring the wheat into the barn. Back in the Jewish age, they didn't have any tares. The plant that grew developed wheat kernels. But the rest of the plant, even though it was Israel, it was of no value to the Lord. He was only interested in the wheat at that time. And that's why John the Baptist says that concerning Jesus, whose winnowing fork is in his hand, he's ready to harvest. And that he'll separate the wheat in the ways that they had of threshing it at that time. And the chaff and all the rest of it is going to be only to be burned. It's not going to last. But now in this time that we're living in, we have to now start a separation work. That's important. Now, one of the findings in these Bible study groups, in the Pastor Russell in particular, was that the expectation of Jesus coming in the flesh, carrying everybody to heaven, was all wrong. That he could never come back in the flesh. It had to be an invisible return. And the time had come now for the harvest work to begin, to start separating the tares from the wheat. You might ask, well, what about the Protestant Reformation? Didn't that do it? Weren't they separated out from that terrible system, the mother of harlots? Well, it's true they were separated. But every one of the groups that formed, it seemed, got involved with the political situation of the time. And they were back to a church-state system of one kind or another. So it was just a matter of creating the daughters of Babylon now instead of having the mother of harlots by herself. But this time, there had to be a separation. And so when the Zion's Watchtower began in 1879, Brother Pollock mentioned that they didn't have the personnel. Now, today we have quite a few Bible schools, even though we're diminishing in numbers. But you think of an ecclesia of having 50 to 100 people. You got people now that can do something for you. They didn't have that. They were small classes. And Pastor Russell came up with the idea that the way we've got to start this harvest work is to get the written information into the hands of people in the churches. So he hired a messenger service. It's called ABC service here in the Pittsburgh area. I don't know if anybody remembers that from Pittsburgh. But anyhow, these people took the literature, which was at that time a tract called Food for Thinking Christians. He had both the tract and he also had a book, a pamphlet. And these were distributed to the people as they came out of the churches. I guess that's kind of tough to do these days, but that's what they were doing back then. Because he knew that the scripture said, Revelation 18:4, come out of her, my people, be not partakers of her sins, don't be partakers of her plague. The time came for separation. And he was bringing the message of truth to those who would come out of her. And that's the strategy that he employed all the way through his ministry. And it worked. There was the time when he sent the Zion's Watchtower, a subscription to Zion's Watchtower, to 90,000 superintendents of Sunday schools. 90,000. Of course, we don't know how many of them responded, but there were some. And it's not for us to try to determine how many. The important thing is to do it and to have this wonderful work done. They needed a book. So the Day Dawn, which is like a composite of the first volume, second volume, and third volume, from going about 343 pages. I've never seen a copy of that book. I'd like to one of these days, but this is what Brother Peyton had written. And so one of the objectives that Pastor also had of making the second pilgrim trip that he made was to go to Elmont, Michigan, and to talk to him. They printed 4,000 of the Day Dawns, and they were distributing these books. Right after these were printed, Pastor Russell ran an article in the Zion's Watchtower. Wanted 1,000 preachers. What did he mean by that? This is the Cole Porter service that he wanted to establish. How many do you suppose that he got? Well, when there was a financial report given, trying to figure out when that was now. I think it was at the end of 1885. Yeah. They had 300 then. 1885. 300 call porters. I tried to get some information about that was really reliable as to how many there were at the end of his ministry in 1916. And the best I could do is a figure that Brother Pollock gave of 1,000 when he was in that type of work. So that's the best figure I can suggest to you. From 300 starting off up to 1,000 at the end of the ministry. And to give you some idea of the size of the operation, I'd like to read a few figures from this financial report, because to me it gives you something to think about. This report, incidentally, in 1879 was such a busy year for Pastor Russell. Not only did he start the Zion's Watchtower, but that's the year he got married. And he became the president of Zion's Watchtower, and Maria Russell became the secretary treasurer, and this is her report. And in making this report, it's mentioned that their indebtedness at the time and their costs for printing the Day Dawn, that was the big venture of the time, and the Zion's Watchtower, was $5,000. And the contributions, $2,600. Now, what else is new? And then we have a Barnabas that came on the scene. You didn't know that there was a Barnabas back there. Remember Barnabas? He had all this land on the island of Cyprus, which he sold in early church days, and he brought it to the apostles and laid it at their feet. Somebody, I don't know who, had land in Florida, and he donated these parcels of land to this work. And one piece of that land was sold, and they kept the other for later. And they got something like $1,850 for it. And that helped reduce the indebtedness to $500 instead of having it $3,000. Now, keep in mind that we're talking about dollars back in 1885. What's the ratio between those dollars and our dollars today? Well, I don't know. Take a lot of digging to find out. What if it's 20 to 1? It's got to be at least that. Maybe it's 30 to 1. And that makes me give you some, gave me some idea of the size of their operation, which would be somewhat like half the size of the Dawn operation today. And the Dawn operation, of course, has a lot of good equipment. But we have the old and the feeble and the gray and a few young persons to lift us up and keep the thing going. Isn't that right, Bob? Yep. Well, it was somewhat like that, too, for Pastor Russell. They didn't have that many people that were working at the time. The volumes, as we know them today, were coming out one at a time. As, for example, volume number one, they made an announcement in 1882 that it was coming. See, they were out of the Day Dawn books that they had been distributing, and they wanted to now replace it with the Millennial Dawn, as they named it. And Pastor Russell knew that the approaches they were using were not working too well. Food for Thinking Christians, which was published about 1881, it tended to attack all the error of the churches. And once they attacked the error, get through maybe four-fifths of the book, then he presented God's plan. By that time, some people weren't interested. They're all mad because they were being attacked. And then Brother Peyton's book, The Day Dawn, it had, as I mentioned, something of a condensation of the second and third volume. And I'd like to read a little point that was made by Pastor Russell when he was now getting the first volume ready for printing. There was a delay. 1882 is when he thought he could get it out, but it took 4 more years before it came out, and he printed 4,000 copies. He was trying to impress the brethren why he was making these changes. And he said this: once the first volume, which we know now as the Divine Plan of the Ages, was issued, he says, "One great advantage of the present arrangement is that if you loan the book to friends or neighbors to read, in glancing over it, they will not be choked," notice he used the word choked, "or stumbled with dates and figures, the value and necessity of which they at first cannot see." Of course, he did publish the second volume on dates and figures, but he was trying to do this stepwise. And he recognized that that's not the way to approach things. You can't attack people's error. Give them the plan. That's the important message to give them. And as a result of that, dear friends, there were, before his ministry came to a close, it almost had 5 million copies of Volume 1 that went out, were distributed. There was almost 1.5 million of Food for Thinking Christians. Don't have any figures on Dadon, but the Tabernacle, which came out in 1885, which really preceded even Volume 1, there was 1 million copies of that. And Volume 1, now almost 5 million, 4,817,000. Volume 2, 1,657,000. Volume 3, 1,578,000. Volume 4, 464,000. And Volume 5, 445,000. Volume 6, 423,000. These are all because they came later. The first three books were the ones that were, well, the first book especially, Volume 1. So you see that there was a tremendous work going on. And it was that of separation, separating those who the Lord wanted to know His plan and who would be willing to make a consecration of their all. And that gives me another point that I would like to make about the memorial. You know, the first time that Pastor Russell observed the memorial was most likely around 18... Let's see if I get this right. I've got to make sure I have the right date here. 1886. I was going to say 85. That would have been wrong. 1886. That's the first mention of a memorial. And after all, you know, the brethren didn't know what they should do. They'd come out of the Babylonian system where they're doing it once a week, the old mass of the Catholic Church, or the Protestants, some of them kept it every week, some kept it once a month, some kept it twice a month. But now they were recognizing that what the Lord always had in mind was they should do it on the memorial of His death, that particular date associated with the Passover. And so Pastor Russell invited some of those that he knew that were in these various little classes throughout the country to come to Allegheny and join with them in the memorial. Well, not many came that first year, but in 1887, they published the figures that there were 150 brethren. These are consecrated brethren. And there are others in other places, but the only figure we have is for Allegheny, 150 brethren, with 40 of them coming from New York and other places that were invited to share with them, because the brethren weren't accustomed to this. Towards the end of his ministry, and here are some amazing figures then. How many do you suppose they had by the time 1914 came about? Well, according to the material that's been reported, there are over 13,000 consecrated brethren in 1914 keeping the memorial. That meant that they partook of the emblems. They were consecrated. And I say plus because when the Watchtower was publishing the figures of who was attending what class, you know, we found out that there are some very large classes. 700 in Chicago? Well, I was in Chicago, but we never had that many. And in New York and Brooklyn, they had something like 1,200 brethren partaking of the memorial. And just going right down the line, 450 in Boston, Massachusetts. The classes that were under 20 in attendance weren't listed. But as I studied all the mathematics of the situation, even though it would be a lot of small classes, they wouldn't add very much to this number of 13,000, maybe about 2,000 at the most. So we say, okay, maybe it's about 15,000 that took it in 1914. 1915 was a peak. They had 16,000 plus. Unless we can again use that 2,000 figures, that means about 18,000. 1916, there was a decline, about 10,000 plus. And I wondered about that. And I've come to the conclusion, whether it's right or wrong, is that after they passed the date 1914, and even though Pastor Russell kept emphasizing how the harvest is not ended, we've got to keep going, we've got to keep working, some just dropped out. Must be. And from then on, there's a decline. There's a decline in the number that we're keeping the memorial throughout the whole world. The work that Pastor Russell did was not only in the U.S. He sent brethren to England in the early days of the... sent Brother Sunderland over there. And he got very sick and had to come home. But there was a Brother Bender over in England who gave out something like 165,000 tracts from London up to Aberdeen. And London had a big class, you know, around 700 people, brethren there. He started a watchtower in Germany around 1880. And before his ministry was over, there were 20 countries, 20 different languages in which the watchtower was printed. It was, harvest was going on, reaching out into Europe and all these other places out of this country. His sermons were syndicated in 2,000 newspapers towards the end of his career. And that, in some cases they say that meant that there's about 4,000 papers that carried his sermons. He was a popular person. But before we close, I would just like to ask this question. What kind of a person was Pastor Russell? I'm going to quote two incidents that I know about personally. After all, I was born 2 years after he died, so I didn't know him personally. But there are brethren that I've talked to that did. Once in Chicago, we had a very interesting meeting. It was right at the time of an anniversary date of his death, of Pastor Russell's death. And they had some of the elders who had been in the Bethel and worked or knew Pastor Russell through other contacts give a little thing that they said was what I remember about Pastor Russell. And the one that I remember was Brother Schiller, who as a young man went to Bethel and he worked there. And he had a nervous breakdown. He had emotional problems. And he said when he had these problems, Pastor Russell brought him into the office. He prayed with him, talked to him. And he says, all that was so good, but I needed more than that. I had to go to a sanitarium finally to recover. But the point that he made was that Pastor Russell had the time. He made the time. I can't think of a busier person. He traveled all over the world. He went everywhere, all because he was interested in the saints. He wanted to meet them. He wanted to help them. He was thoroughly dedicated. There's no doubt about it. And the other thing that I remember is that when we moved over to the New York area, we were talking with Sister Lundquist, that many of our New York friends know. She had a boarding house at the time that Pastor Russell was in charge of Bethel. And it was a time when he was emphasizing that justification now couldn't be just for those who were called, but they had to make a consecration. And then it would be vitalized. And there are some brethren who oppose that idea. And they oppose it by being so vociferous that they said all kinds of terrible things about him. So I says to Sister Lundquist, how did he take that? And her face lit up and she says, oh, he was all sweetness and light. It didn't disturb him at all. After all, he was teaching others that they should follow after the master, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. And he was also carrying out that particular part of his Christian life. Well, friends, the harvest is still going on. Let us be inspired by this example that we have here of the work that was done so many years ago. May the Lord add his blessing.
The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. Amen.